John Hancock helped lead the Missouri Republican Party to one of its greatest victories in modern history. But it wasn't all triumph and glory. Hancock gives a candid assessment of his chairmanship of the Missouri Republican Party on another edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say. Hands to kiss and babies to shake.
But I think my record speaks for itself.
It's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio in St. Louis is
colleague Joe Manis.
And returning to the show for the second time, a very victorious guest we have in studio today is
John Hancock,
the soon-to-be former chairman of the Missouri Republican
Party. A title
Party.
I have aspired to hold for 2 years, former chairman.
That's saying something. By saying that, you would give the impression to our audience that, you know, the last couple of weeks were a terrible failure for the Missouri Republican instead of the biggest triumph in its history. But
it worked out well, didn't it?
Well, I think it's clear to say, actually, that the 2 years that you've handled the party, for better or for worse, has been two of the most eventful years that the Missouri Republican Party has probably seen in decades, if not modern history. I mean, starting with the very tragic, I mean, you took office just a few days before the tragic
suicide
of state auditor, then gubernatorial candidate Tom Schweik. You got caught, snared in all that.
Which was a subject of our last show.
Yeah, and we can mention briefly that later, but then now you're leaving after the state GOP had this huge blowout on November 8th, won all the statewide offices that were on the ballot. Now, some credit, and I argue a decent amount of credit, goes to Donald Trump.
No question.
There was a Trump train.
No question.
So I'm just interested in your thoughts. I mean, where you're seeing your tenure bookended by two rather momentous events, and so now you're leaving on a pretty high note.
Yeah, it's a little hard to believe. You have to pinch myself sometimes. I expected that this could have been a really good year. But man, I mean, you talk about the peaks and valleys of this thing and the emergence of Donald Trump, which split state parties all across the country.
Well, it split and Missouri's too, to some degree.
A little bit. But you know, we all sort of hung in there.
Yeah.
And rode the train as it sped up and slowed down at different points along the way. And it was just a crazy cycle. And I knew when I ran for chairman that this 2016 was going to be a monumental year, and for better or worse, if Chris Koster would have been elected governor, we would have had Chris Koster at the top of that ticket for, who knows, decades to come, for governor and U.S. Senate and eventually maybe president or vice president, and that would have could have potentially framed state politics for the rest of our lives. So it was a very consequential election cycle.
Now, why do you think Trump won the state by nearly 20 percentage points, given that he didn't really have robust support among, you know, political officials during the primary, even after the primary?
Well, actually, he had really no major. I mean, the only major people who endorsed him in the primary was Phyllis Schlafly. Yeah. Now, by Cleveland, and I was in Cleveland with Hancock and a bunch of others, everybody was in line, but there were still a lot of Cruz people who were still doing so.
And also, just to add, I don't think Trump really put in a lot of money or organization into the state like, for example,
no.
You know, George W. Bush did in his two cycles.
Certainly in 2000 they did, and to a lesser extent in 2004. No, Trump had two full-time paid staff in the state.
And they were respected guys.
But they were two people.
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine how many paid staffers there were in 2004 or even 2008. Probably triple or quadruple that amount.
And with full field operations, you know, we had paid field staff. Now, with the Blunt campaign, well, we'll get to the Blunt campaign in a minute. But as it relates to Trump, the question, why did he win it so by such a large margin? One was that Hillary Clinton really was a bad candidate, and she was a bad candidate in 2008. She was a bad candidate in 2016, and there just was not any passion for her. There was a tremendous amount of passion for Donald Trump, not from traditional establishment Republicans, but in the grassroots, a tremendous amount of passion. And we saw a lot of people getting involved and volunteering who maybe hadn't voted in 8, 12, 16, 20 years. I went to a concert with a musician friend after the election, and he invited another musician friend who I had not met. And the guy was 64 years old, and he voted for the first time in 2016. So, I mean, that tells you something.
Well, what is it about Trump that you think especially motivated people in rural Missouri to get out and vote? Because we've talked about that a lot on this show, and it seems counterintuitive that a thrice-married billionaire from New York City who really has no personal commonalities with people in rural Missouri would do so well there. Part of it has to be what you said, Hillary Clinton was not a good candidate. But what was it about Donald Trump that touched the nerve there?
Well, I think that book, what's it called, Hillbilly Elegy, that,
yes,
that came out. Yeah, I think that guy kind of hits the nail on the head. You look across these rural communities, towns across, spread out, not just in Missouri, but
elsewhere,
all over the country. And so many of these towns were built on the shoe factory or the plant or whatever.
Or the glass factory. I grew up in a little town in Indiana at the glass factory, too. And I've talked about this many times.
Yeah, and those jobs are gone. Those communities don't look like they used to look. And so along comes a guy talking about keeping jobs in our country, talking about making America great again, and whatever that may mean for the hearer. And I think what he tapped into was a sense that the country was woefully adrift, that politicians had been singularly ineffective at addressing a lot of the problems, politicians in both parties. And I think that is the passion and the emotion that Donald Trump's message tapped into, and it resonated clearly. 18-point win.
Now, without getting into the weeds on this, because we've got a lot of things we want to talk to you about, and we don't want to beat all the Washington stuff, but still, will those voters stick with the GOP, let's say 2 years from now, if they don't see some change in those little towns? I mean, because, you know, many people, and I'll openly say this, will the glass factories come back to the little town that I grew up in?
No.
They're in China somewhere. And the shoe factories, they're in China somewhere. So when you're looking, I mean, is there a danger for the GOP, not just in Missouri, but elsewhere, if there isn't some sort of tangible evidence of change in those towns by 2018? Or do you think those voters are going to have patience and see a long view?
Well, we'll see. There's always danger for a party when it bears full governing responsibility. And that was certainly true of the Democrats going into the 2010 midterms. They had the federal government, and they got shellacked in the midterms. So there's always that danger present, and we certainly, both in Missouri and nationally, there's nobody, if things don't go well, there's nobody to point the finger at. It's the Republicans that are in charge. So now, conversely, if things do go well and you see economic growth and you really do see approaching 4% growth in jobs and so forth, then, you know, this could be a very long-lasting, realigning almost type of election.
So we'll have 4 to 8 years to talk about Donald Trump in various podcasts. But I do want to get more on a state level.
Yeah,
because you have a similar view now with – you have a similar situation, although different, with the governor-elect Eric Greitens, you know, who does not have political experience, but he is nationally known for his charity work and for being a best-selling author. So he is an outsider. It wasn't like a bunch of the state party people were with him.
Right.
So when you're looking at this, he's now going to be running the state government. He's already made what some would see as a smart choice to replace you, because you were planning to leave anyway.
Yes, I was.
But with Todd Graves.
A great choice. I mean, I couldn't be more pleased with that choice. I think Todd is perfect for this role at this time.
In what way? Does he mesh with Greitens' sort of image or what?
No, I think Todd is, he's politically savvy. He's media savvy. He can raise money. He's been a candidate. He's been a statewide candidate.
Yes.
He's been an office holder. He's been the U.S. attorney. He's got the kind of breadth of different experiences that I think work out particularly well in a state party context. He's been there. He's done that. And I think people that may not know him yet that are on the state committee are going to grow to really appreciate his leadership. It's a great choice.
Now, not to delve into the not-so-good past, but you were caught in this whirlwind at the beginning of your tenure in this conversation about whether there was rampant anti-Semitism in Missouri politics or within Missouri Republican politics. Now, flash forward 2 years, and Eric Greitens made history by becoming the first Jewish governor in Missouri history by winning most of rural Missouri, which is not overly Jewish. What do you think that – what sort of message do you think that sends, especially about what you went through?
Well,
and what,
I,
and
you know, I
through.
Never – thought you go back and listen to our last interview, I never thought that being Jewish was a negative attribute to run for office in Missouri, and particularly as Republicans, because if you look at the evangelical base of our party, there's a lot of appeal for Jewish candidates among that base. And so I never, you know, if I were going to go out and whisper campaign about somebody, it wouldn't be that they were Jewish. It would, you know. That's not, it just, you know, isn't the kind of thing that matters. And I think Eric ran a masterful campaign, and he certainly, you know, having the support and the financial support he did, that didn't hurt either. But he ran a masterful campaign, and you know, a year ago, you couldn't find five people who would tell you that Chris Koster could be defeated.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody assumed that Koster was going to win. So this was a big, big, big victory for Eric.
And I just want to just add really quickly before Joe jumps in, while I don't think his religion was a huge emphasis in his campaign, I have read interviews where he talked about how his faith directed him in public service. And I just from personal standpoint, as somebody who is Jewish, mm-hmm. and as somebody who has four generations of people that's lived in Missouri, it was hard not to think of that was a significant milestone for the
no
Jewish
question.
Community in Missouri, regardless of your politics. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was intrigued by, the conventional wisdom, and I'm interested in your take on this, is that if the Trump train, if it hadn't been 18 points—
right.
And if it had been 10, let's say, 10 or 12, that Koster might still have won narrowly. At least that's been some of the – do you question that? I mean, do you think that Greitens' own campaign would have put him on top anyway? I know this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but that's part of what our podcast
is. Well, you'll never know for sure, obviously. I know that – because our governor's race takes place in the presidential cycle, and most states don't, it tends to get covered up some. Now, in this particular year, there wasn't any presidential advertising to speak of in the market in either of the big cities.
But there was still a lot of attention.
A lot of attention. You know, there probably is a point at which, you know, a Trump lead would not have been sufficient enough for Blunt and Greitens. Whether that was 10 points or 8 points or 12 points, who knows?
Right.
But for sure, in order to win those races, particularly after having a divisive late primary in August, you've got to get some lift from the top of the ticket.
And I was just going to ask this because both Blunt and Greitens did something that several other Republicans didn't do across the country, especially after that October Access Hollywood video where Trump seemed to be completely in a death spiral. You saw Republican candidates all over the country disavowing Trump, including Ann Wagner. And Blunt and Greitens didn't do that. And I think that regardless of whether you think that was morally right, from a tactical standpoint, I think that was a crucial moment for both of them because Trump ended up winning the state by a huge margin. And had they disavowed him, that could have lost them support of some Trump voters.
Well, I mean, to be fair, though, neither Greitens nor Blunt, and this was arguably smart as well, it wasn't like they were wrapping themselves in Trump
from
the get-go. They were basically
they didn't pull a Mark Kirk or a Kelly Ayotte. I don't know if I...
Ayotte. Yeah.
They didn't disavow them or saying I wasn't going to endorse them anymore. And I whether or not you agree with them from a moral standpoint, I think it's hard to argue that wasn't a smart tactical decision by both of them. What do you think about
that? Well, you know, at the time when that all happened, and that was, 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks out, something like that. And, you know, Trump was, in our own internal polling, he was at anywhere from 11 to 14 up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, see, now that's interesting to know. So he's 11 to 14 up in Missouri, even with that going on.
Well, as it happened. And so he lost a little ground for a few days. But... And the challenge for a Roy Blunt and Eric Greitens is that there were two kinds of Trump voters that were non-traditional. You had non-traditional Republicans that may not participate all that often. And you had a good number of Democrats that were voting for him. And it wasn't the case where Greitens or Blunt, certainly not Blunt, were going to get those Democrats that were Trump voters. But they couldn't afford to alienate the Republican Trump voters and the new voters that were out there. So it was a very difficult, I mean, I don't think it was a difficult decision. And I think both of them handled it with a fair amount of tact and precision. And I think it ended up working out well.
Now, one of the intriguing things about the Senate race, because I think this is one of the more high-profile Senate races, definitely nationally, but also in Missouri, this was a case where I would say that the Senate race almost overshadowed the governor's race, depending on the week.
Right.
But were there particular things that Blunt did that you think helped him overcome the candor threat? I mean, because he only won by three.
Yeah.
Blunt did.
I'm well aware.
So
of that.
I mean, if the Trump train had been closer, I really do believe Blunt might have been a casualty.
Yeah. Or if he would have performed worse with Trump voters than
right.
he ended up doing. So, you know, I think the key moments in that race between Jason Kander and the DSCC and the independent super PACs that were all running the family lobbying message, mm-hmm. they had, I don't know, close to 10,000 points behind
it. It was
that.
Unbelievable. Yes. I have never seen so many ads for one candidate before.
And it clearly was resonating and was working. And Roy's campaign waited a bit before really taking that attack head on. And they finally did. They finally answered it, pointed out that Kander's wife was a lobbyist. And
now, Kander says she's not, but we're not
well, whatever.
Go.
I mean, yeah. But regardless, I think at the point he engaged in that argument, I think that was when the tide began to turn in the race. And then the other key thing that the Blunt campaign did consistently. So if you're going to beat an incumbent, and Jason Kander was going to beat an incumbent who had a lot of money and was well-known, you've got to do two things. You've got to disqualify the incumbent. And Kander's campaign did a good job of that, in my opinion, as a political professional.
Yeah, we're just talking about strategy here.
But the other thing you've got to do then, once you've discredited the incumbent, you've got to demonstrate that you're an acceptable alternative. And I don't believe Kander ever met that standard. And when the Blunt campaign... So Kander tried to move the message, and they put the points behind it that Roy Blunt was a corrupt insider.
Okay.
The Blunt campaign moved the message and put the points behind it that Jason Kander was an out-of-touch liberal who would not support the policies that Missourians wanted. And that message ultimately, I think, carried the day in a very close election. Plus, we had about a $5.5 million victory program that was focused on that Senate race and the governor's race, because we knew those races were going to be close.
Mm-hmm. Now I want to ask this question, because not taking anything away from Jason Kander's campaign, which I think was well above average, given that he only won.
It was above average, but not as good as some are crediting.
Let me ask this question.
All right, okay.
We got time.
Besides the gun ad, his messaging was almost identical to what Robin Carnahan did in 2010.
True.
In fact, some of the arguments were identical.
True.
Yet Robin Carnahan isn't being touted as a presidential candidate. Robin Carnahan isn't being asked to be the DNC chairman. Granted, she lost by a larger margin.
14 points.
But why do you think there's so much celebration about Jason Kander's campaign when he basically ran a very similar campaign to Robin Carnahan's?
He came out of nowhere. Carnahan was a known quantity. And so Kander, like Eric Greitens, really had zero name ID going into this thing. And so he came from nowhere. And that can be a huge advantage. Mm-hmm. Where I take issue with the folks who are saying, oh, it was the greatest campaign ever, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't. Because he did precisely half of what he needed to do in order to win. And he had a lot of help. I mean, they put 10,000 points behind that spot. He assembled the gun. He did a couple of face-to-camera things about his values or what, but he did not establish himself as an acceptable alternative.
Now, I don't want to get a big debate on the air, but, I mean, Jason, I take issue. I don't think he did the same kind of campaign that Robin Carnahan did. In fact, I think Kander's was stronger for a number of reasons, but we But Robin Carnahan tried to tighten herself closer to Bush. She was in favor of some of the Bush policies. I think she muddied the waters, but I think
10 was a bad year for Democrats.
Yeah, 2010.
The only thing I agree with you, the only thing I would say is just some of the specific argument and messaging was similar. That's what I was trying to get
at. But on the other hand, she was sort of in Blunt's position. There was a huge deluge of anti-Carnahan ads that ran in September and October of 2010. In fact, I wrote about them. I mean, the National Chamber, some of the other third-party groups just dumped all this anti-Carnahan ads, and the Democrats didn't counter at all. Whereas this time, it was almost in reverse, where there was arguably at least as much, if not more, anti-Blunt stuff as outside anti-Kander stuff.
And, you know, the other main difference between those two campaigns, of course, is that Robin Carnahan had no capacity to communicate that she was a fresh face or an outsider. And, you know, the name had been in Missouri politics for decades.
Fair.
And whereas Kander, while he was Secretary of State and had been a state representative, he was not a political newcomer.
Right.
But to
he
was a brand new idea.
Now, I want to get back to something else, because when I was talking about the October surprise, I could not stop thinking about what happened in 2012 with Todd Akin. There were some similarities.
Yeah. Although that was August.
Yeah, that was the August surprise.
That was
August 19th,
surprise.
To be
and
precise.
And I think there were a lot of reporters, including myself, who thought that the same trajectory was going to unfold, that was going to be the catalyst for Trump to lose a lot of ground, similar to Todd Akin did. Now, that didn't happen.
Didn't.
In fact, it went the opposite direction. As a political person, why do you think Todd Akin sunk like an anvil after his legitimate rape gaffe, yet Trump managed not to be fatally harmed by his?
Well, Donald Trump is a fundamentally different kind of political figure that we've ever seen before. He was a known commodity from reality television for years. And, you know, people had, I think, already baked into the cake that he, you know, would say and do some very provocative things. And it,
and they didn't care.
And they didn't seem to care that much. Whereas, you know, I think in Akin's case, he'd been in Congress for 12 years. But he was really in an introductory mode running for a statewide office like that. And I think those comments just sunk him immediately. Plus, the McCaskill campaign in 12 did a very good job of capitalizing on that and then building on it throughout into the fall.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to be back as a political consultant.
Yes.
Do you expect to be doing some clients here? And
hope so.
Might you be involved? I mean, in 2018 is going to be a big Senate year in Missouri, because McCaskill is going to be running
race.
For mm-hmm. re-election. We're not sure about Auditor Galloway's plans yet, but the assumption is she is.
No, I think she's running for re-election. We just don't know which Republican is going to run.
Well, the fact that's going to ask you. I mean, granted, obviously you're not going to be telling any private stuff, but just looking at it from the field, do you see where there could be another GOP primary?
Yeah.
To get the nominee, and whether or not my contention is, I think you and some others over the years have been concerned about, because the primaries tend to take so much money out of the party because the candidates are spending all this money, this
right.
and that. But I've come to believe that actually it tends to help as a rule, because they get so much publicity that the winner sometimes gets a bump if they're not too damaged. I'm just looking at the...
Well, that's the key.
The GOP the race this time. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are. Look into 2018, when there arguably will be a GOP primary to take on McCaskill.
And my guess will be that they'll both be multi-candidate primaries.
Okay.
And I, you know, my belief is that we emerge, anybody, but Republicans emerge better, less damaged from a multi-candidate primary than a two-way. A two-way primary, or even if there's more than two, but if there are two main candidates, that tends to produce a much more badly wounded nominee than a multi-candidate field does. And I think the fact that we had four running for governor did help us. And to your point, Joe, I think Eric came out of that process not so damaged.
Right.
And much better known than he would have been probably otherwise.
Even though they had, I mean, for a while, during our radio debate that we had, the four, which was a highlight for one of the highlights for me, because I thought our primer at least was issue. Right, I mean, our radio debate was pretty issue. But all three of his rivals really zeroed in on him, went after him over some donors and some other stuff. But it was intriguing to me that, yes, once he won, most of them were quiet. Catherine Hanaway immediately turned around and endorsed him and actually became a prominent supporter. Were there any lessons, I guess what I'm saying, going into 2012 from that experience that you hope the party or the activists, take to heart?
Well, what I did as the chairman was we sat down with these people, not just the governor people, but every contested primary and the statewides in February. And they all committed, pledged that they were going to support the nominee, and it didn't go off without a hiccup. but at the end of that process, they all did endorse the nominee, and we weren't able to put together the kumbaya breakfast meeting that I had envisioned.
I'm sure you were torn up over that.
Saved a couple hundred bucks, and but they did all endorse the nominee, and more importantly. Nary a bad thing was said about the nominee after the primary by any.
Well, did it help that in especially the governor's race, there just really weren't a lot of issue distinctions? I'm not saying there were none, like Eric Greitens came out against SJR 39, which was controversial. But it's not like Greitens, especially what he said during the primary, was that much different issue-wise.
Well, and I think you got to see Republicans, Missouri Republicans are pretty – I mean, there's not a whole lot of – ideological diversity out there. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much typical. I did want to make one other point about the governor's race. I think perhaps the biggest tactical mistake that was made by any campaign this last year was the Koster campaign in sitting on $10 million during the month of July when all of the Republicans were out there attacking Greitens, attacking Bruner, attacking Hanaway. He hoarded his money and didn't go up, and he had some very good ads when he went up in early August, but he did not avail himself of that window to contrast himself with the squabbling Republicans during July, which Jay Nixon did masterfully 8 years early. Remember, Nixon's campaign in July of 2008, he was driving around in his pickup truck down in Jefferson County, talking to his dog, and he drove his favorables way
I'm glad you mentioned that because I was actually watching that ad yesterday, and it's that ad to me says a lot of things. Even though Jay Nixon at that point had lived in Jefferson City for 16 years, he came off as an authentic rural Missourian. And DeSoto, I say, is kind of ruralish, even though it's in Jefferson County.
Well, to St. Louis, it's rural.
And I think that he really had a legitimate connection with rural voters. You saw that in 2008 where he won most of outstate Missouri. You saw that even in 12 where he did pretty well. Even though Koster did a lot of stylistic and policy-oriented things to try to appeal to rural Missouri.
He got the Farm Bureau endorsement.
He got the Farm Bureau endorsement, NRA endorsement. He didn't do nearly as well. And I just wonder if it's a less tangible thing that happened that rural Missouri just didn't find him authentic as Nixon, possibly.
Or did he not take advantage? I mean, I think one of the things that Hancock is bringing up, should he have been running ads in July saying, I'm the NRA guy, I'm the Farm Bureau guy?
Now, he hadn't gotten those endorsements at that point, but he certainly had the opportunity, and he's good on camera.
Yeah.
Chris Koster is good on camera. I think we can all agree. And he had that opportunity, and the contrast of him being good on camera is much more profound when you're running that against Republican attack spots that are going on during that same window.
Between each other, not against
between
him.
Between each other. Mm-hmm. And that, he had an opportunity there to drive his favorables high enough that he maybe could have withstood. I don't know whether he could have withstood an 18-point Donald Trump
train. I mean, the Trump train kind of.
But he certainly tactically made, in my opinion, a big mistake.
And I think there was another tactical error that he made, and I don't mean to dump on Koster. I respect him as a person. I still think he's a very skilled political figure, regardless
of
this result. But I think when his first attack was against the Mission Continues and not against, say, Greitens donors or his lack of governmental experience, I thought that was a mistake because regardless of what you think about Eric Greitens as a political figure, it's almost universal that the Mission Continues is seen as a pretty noble enterprise. And I think to to say that he was basically insinuating that he was taking money from it was a mistake, because the message was kind of confusing, and I think it was attacking his strength that was not really that he really that I don't think Koster could really knock down a peg. I don't know if you noticed that too, but I certainly
I did. I did, and I wish. I think Eric responded to it effectively, but I think he could have responded to it perhaps even more effectively by saying, "Look, everybody that runs a charity the size of mine, the chief executive, this is the salary they make. This was my salary. I wasn't taking money. I was actively running this organization. We put $10 million a year to help veterans, direct benefits to veterans." And I think that would have obliterated.
And that's what I was trying to get at. I used to be on a board of a nonprofit right after I graduated from Mizzou, and we paid our executive director a salary. And this was the similar situation.
$150,000, $200,000 is common. You go to these hospital foundations, Children's Hospital or Cardinal Glenn. I mean, those executives are making hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So, yes, continue, Joe.
So, I'm not going to get – I mean, I've got my own thoughts on some of this stuff, but looking broader, okay, do you think as a result of the election, looking at the three GOP, losers for governor and Koster, do you see a future for any of them? I mean, looking at it objectively as a tactician, not as a Republican Party chairman, or do you think all four of those people are probably going to be doing other things?
Well, Koster certainly has an entry point. Because the Democrats have such a dearth of candidates and their bench is very thin.
Yeah, but he's going to have to wait 6 years.
He will have to wait a while. On the Republican side, this is an interesting dynamic. Mm-hmm. So, we've had these multi-candidate primaries, and we're going to have two more of them, I predict, in 18 for the U.S. Senate and for auditor. Three, four.
Do you expect
candidates.
Any of these candidates for governor to try to run for,
could,
for
because,
Senate?
Because it's really the last opportunity. If you're a Republican that has statewide ambitions, 2018 could be the last train leaving the station, because what's going to happen in 20 is that the entire statewide ticket are going to be incumbents running for reelection. Mm-hmm. So there is no entry point there if you're an aspirational office holder, on your way to the White House, and you need to be the state treasurer for, whatever it may be.
And there won't be a Senate race on the ballot.
And there's
in
no Senate race. And so, and when the next time there is a Senate race, it'll be blunt or open, potentially, depending on what.
Yeah, 22. Yeah.
And 22. But so 18 is the last train leaving the station if you want to run. And that's why I think you're going to see multi-candidate primary.
Well, this is going to be my question, because there are obviously a lot of possible Republican candidates to run for U.S. Senate.
Sure.
They could be anywhere from a congressperson like Ann Wagner, Vicky Hartzler, Sam Graves. It could be somebody in the state legislature like Todd Richardson, or even somebody who's non-leadership like Paul Kirtman. It could be Peter Kinder, Catherine Hanaway, John Bruner, possibly. Do you think that it may be better for the candidate to run against McCaskill not to be a member of Congress, so they could kind of contrast their lack of federal experience? Or do you think that may not matter
in
2018?
It's too early to try and define the cycle for 18. It's going to be dependent on where Trump's job approval is. It's going to be dependent on what Congress has passed and gotten signed into law. It's going to be dependent on where the state of the economy, the job situation, jobs in the economy are the top issue. That's one set of facts. If foreign policy and terrorism is the top issue, which it could be in 2018, that's a different kind of race. So, and if it ends up being that, then somebody that's got some national experience and has served on some committees that deal with foreign affairs and defense and anti-terrorism, that's going to be a good resume tool. So you just don't know yet what that cycle is going to look like.
Now, during these 2 years, and we've mentioned, it had some highs and some lows, but just looking at it in broadly, as you're leaving, are there any lessons, lessons that you take from all this that's going to help you as you go back into consulting?
Well, I've learned some lessons about the state party.
Because you've been executive director before. So were there lessons this time that you
didn't
know
from before?
Oh, there's
no question. Yeah, the state party used to be more of a quarterback for what the party and the ticket were doing, and kind of helping to sort out primaries ahead of time. And they're really, certainly with the finance law that existed in 16, the state party was not a quarterback. I wasn't calling the plays, and that just is not true. The state party, though, is a pretty good field goal kicker. And that if you can put the resources together, because the campaigns all say they're going to have a ground game, but they never do. And if you can put the resources together and get the campaigns working with the party, and we succeeded in that, to execute voter identification and turnout programs, making sure that you're getting mail out to get the vote out, and do those kinds of things, and that's a field goal. That's 2-3 points. And I do think we effectively put a few points on the board. And in a race like Roy Blunt's, it made a difference.
Now, without belaboring whether or not the law stands or anything, but yeah, right now we have campaign donation limits again. Mm. Does that resurrect the state parties as far as maybe going from the field goal kicker to the quarterback again, or will they have a different role because of the more robust third-party groups I'm interested in?
All of these reforms end up, at the end of the day, strengthening outside non-party groups.
Just for our listeners, the amendment puts a $25,000 donation cap on parties, but no cap on third parties.
Okay.
But continue.
Yeah,
and no corporate money to political parties, which I think is will have a weakening effect on the state party by not being able to raise that corporate money that we used to. That was the bread and butter of
right.
the state party. So I think it will empower third parties who can go out and get corporate money, whatever they can. And I don't necessarily believe. Well, I don't believe. That's a good thing for the system. All these reforms that we've implemented, all of which were designed to clean up the political system, in my opinion, have weakened a very intricate system that developed over many, many years that really brought some sanity and sensitivity to the political system. And, you almost, though, have to live and breathe the political system like we do to understand why some of these reforms are not such a good idea.
We'll be following those changes for many years, but we just want to thank you for coming in. You're welcome back anytime, even though you'll just be the former chairman
And one thing I don't want people to forget, aside from being the chairman, from being a political consultant, I mean, you have done some radio anchor duties. Do you plan on keeping some of that? And Hancock is a crack piano player.
Yeah, when all else fails, you'll find me in Branson at a theater.
Check him out in Branson, folks. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JManNies.
How would we follow you on Twitter or any other place on the World Wide Web?
John R. Hancock.
We'll be back next time. Until then, so long.